We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson, the producer for the show, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In the early 1960s, the BBC ruled the airwaves in Britain. That is, until its monopoly was challenged by a bunch of renegades broadcasting rock and roll from the high seas. Some of those people just wanted to entertain, but there were others who actually had a political agenda, one that opposed public service media and what they saw as the British welfare state. This morning on Focus, we will talk with Adrian Johns. He is professor of history at University of Chicago, and he is the author of a new book which looks at the story of British pirate radio and how a battle between two pirate kings led to a murder and also led to some fundamental changes in British broadcasting. His book is Death of a Pirate, British Radio and the Making of the Information Age. It is published by W.W. Norton. As I mentioned, Adrian Johns is professor of history at University of Chicago. He was educated in Britain at Cambridge, and he is a specialist in the area of intellectual property and piracy. And he's joining us this morning from there, from University of Chicago. We're pleased that he could spend some time with us and talk. Questions are welcome from people who are listening. If you'd like to call in, and you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you can also send along comments by email right to will-talk. That's W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. We hope people will be brief. That way we can get in as many callers as possible. And hope you can stay on the topic, but your input is certainly welcome. Professor Johns, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I think it's very interesting. I was holding off trying to say something like we would be talking about the history of broadcasting in Britain, how it came to be, how it is, and maybe also why it's different from the United States. I was afraid if I said something like that, people would go running for their radios and immediately want to turn them off. But myself, and maybe just because I'm in this business, I think it's really a fascinating story, particularly this question of why it is that radio in so many other places around the world is one way, and here in the United States, it's something very different.
Yeah, that's true. And the story does go back to the 1920s and the origins of broadcasting. I think we forget now what a radically strange thing broadcasting was when it came along, partly because we've got used to the proliferation of media. So since, say, the late 19th century, we've had cinemas, sound recording, tape, you know, and now digital stuff. But broadcasting was different because it was really the first medium where a message just went out from a central location and you couldn't track who received it at all. It went out just to everybody and anybody in principle could pick it up. That created really kind of major cultural and conceptual problems for regulating it. And for that matter, for financing it. You know, how do you set up an enterprise like this such that it pays for itself? And different countries solve them in different ways, eventually arriving at what are more or less two models. There's the American model on one side, which is largely private corporations through the 20s, which tended to agglomerate into networks. And then there's the British model, which was emulated by several European countries and elsewhere, places like Australia and Canada, where there is a central public service broadcaster, which is not quite an arm of government. It's a kind of hybrid operation. It's supposed to have the character of a private corporation, but with a public source of funding and with a public service ethos, most importantly. Mm. Those two models have really been in tension or sometimes conflict ever since then. And the 60s story of pirate radio is really a kind of moment in that bigger history of broadcasting itself.
Well, if you if one goes back to Britain in the early 60s, say before Radio Caroline went on, which I think was the first one, and you say, well, okay, so you're 1962 or something like that, and you're in London and you turn on the radio and you start tuning around the dial, what options do you have?
The options that you have in the early 60s? They're pretty limited, especially if you lived outside the southeast of England. If you live in the southeast, then you can pick up continental stations. If you have a good enough receiver, then you may even pick up something from the United States. Radio Luxembourg is the big broadcaster on the continent, a commercial operation with big ambitions. It aspired to be a kind of global media outfit, and it broadcast in the English language, and it broadcast pop music records, which the BBC had a very limited ability to do. So you could pick up Radio Luxembourg. That's the big competitor. But really, you're pretty much stuck with the BBC at that point. Mm. And then, like you say, in 62, 63, 64, a proliferation of boats and offshore fort stations start broadcasting what was called pirate radio into the UK. Caroline wasn't actually the first. The first one was actually called Radio Atlanta. Caroline came along about a month after. Let me correct myself. I've got this back to front. Atlanta was the first one to try to set up an operation, but due to a bit of kind of underhand, almost sabotage, Caroline ended up being the first one on the air. That you're right. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
And even though we refer to them as pirates, one of the things we should note is that technically speaking, what they were doing was not illegal.
It was not strictly illegal, although there were differences of opinion on that. Mm. There was an international regime for regulating telecommunications, and these stations were using wavelengths that were not assigned to them under that regime. But the relation between that regime and any national legal system was not kind of fixed, and the stations themselves claimed to be outside territorial waters, so they weren't subject to British legal restrictions in any case. Their view was that they were not illegal, but they were unauthorized.
Yeah. And
they could also point to a number of other stations which were regarded as above board, which also were not obeying, as it were, the international telecommunications regime. Things like Voice of America, for example, at that point had transmitters that were not in the system.
So what they were doing in competing with the BBC was not only were they simply offering competition, because, as you say, there would have been places in the UK where you couldn't get anything else. So not only they were offering something else to listen to, but something very different to listen to, because the BBC at this point had this very strong sense of mission that said that broadcasting ought to be for the improvement of the general population. And so the kind of programming that they broadcast was rather staid. It was kind of like spinach as opposed to cake, and that the pirates came along and said, well, people want cake, let's give them a cake. And then what they started to do particularly was broadcast a kind of pop music that young people, I'm sure, in the UK were interested in listening to. But the BBC just simply wouldn't play.
That's right. The BBC, it was not entirely opposed to playing pop music. To some extent, it was a victim of agreements that had been made in the early post-war era that limited the number of hours it could devote to broadcasting recordings. So this was a product of a kind of alliance between the recording industry and the musicians' unions, which imposed this agreement on the BBC. So it's not entirely the case that it just refused to play pop music. To some extent, it couldn't. Mm. But it is true also that its institutional purpose, its ethos, was to improve the culture of the British nation. And so it did tend to think of itself as offering, as Lord Reith, its first chairman, said, slightly better than what people think they want. Mm. So to that extent, it was not kind of it wasn't aligned very much with the pop music revolution of the 60s. There was greater variety, though, also on the side of the pirate stations. Some of them were devoted to out-and-out pop music for teenagers and the like. But there were also pirate stations, and in some ways more successful ones, that were devoted to something like a housewife audience. So people who were not in work, but wanted to listen to, as it were, light music through the day. And those tend to be less hard-edged. But they were a real part of the pirate radio phenomenon as well.
We have a caller here. Rather than make them late, wait, I want to bring them into the conversation, but let me also again introduce our guest, Adrian Johns. He's professor of history at University of Chicago. He's a specialist on intellectual property and is the author of the new book, Death of a Pirate, which looks at British pirate radio in the UK in the early 60s, and how radio changed as a result of the presence of the pirates. The title of his book is Death of a Pirate, British Radio and the Making of the Information Age, and it's published by W.W. Norton. We have a caller to bring in, someone in Champaign, so let's do that. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have several questions. I'll bring them up and then listen to your response on the air. The first point is that this recent movie, which I saw, which there's a DVD of called Pirate Radio, which I found fascinating. I found it especially fascinating for its portrayal of the attitude of the British bureaucracy and what I find is the offensive and oppressive attitude of government in controlling media. I don't know how accurate it is, and I'll let you speak to that. It's interesting that not only in that movie, but there's another movie, O Brother, Where Art Thou, which you might know by the Coen brothers, which as a side picture, you get a sense of American radio broadcasting. Again, I'm not sure how accurate it is, but this was particularly in the South, and it's in the probably 20s and 30s. And it's, again, another very interesting picture of the, I'll call it the Wild West of broadcasting, of the openness and the lack of regulation. And that sort of ties those two together to the central question of should there be government regulation, and is the differences, such as you talked about, between the United States and Great Britain or Europe, part of the issues of government control of individuals, which is European model and certainly the British model in all sorts of ways, which we now have a shorthand called the nanny state, and freedom of the press and more open attitudes in some ways in the United States. So I'll get off the air and see if you want to touch on any or all of those.
All right. Well, that should keep us going for the rest of the hour, I guess. To start out, maybe some people did in fact see this movie, Pirate Radio, that was out in, I think, in 2009. And I gather that was in fact loosely based on one of these. I think it was actually, was it Radio Atlanta that it was based on? Or no, I guess it was Radio Caroline I think it was based on.
I think it's Caroline.
I think so.
It doesn't look like Atlanta to me. I did see that film. I think I was one of the few people, me and your listener, who saw that film in the United States. It wasn't around for very long. It captures some aspects of the reality, I think, in the 60s. So there was this air of liberation to the pirate stations and a kind of happy-go-lucky character to them. And some of the episodes that are shown on the film, I think, are based on real episodes. The part of it that I actually thought was least good is the portrayal of the other side, the establishment and the government and the post office and BBC, which are portrayed in kind of cartoonishly bureaucratic terms. Kenneth Branagh represents, I can't remember whether he's the minister or the postmaster general, and he's obviously, you know, hamming it up as the killjoy of the whole enterprise. I don't really think it was like that. I think that the government was in a much trickier position than that film portrays. And it wasn't entirely unsympathetic to the idea that you know, freedom matters. For much of the time, after all, this was a Labour government. And in fact, as the crisis accelerated through 66, 67, the responsible minister was Tony Benn, who's actually a very in the vanguard, as it were, of a kind of popular libertarian socialism in the UK, has been ever since then. Mm. It's clear that his position was very ambiguous. He felt rather tortured about what should be done about these stations. I think that the movie gives quite a good portrayal of the ships, not a good portrayal of the other side. I think the other side was much more mixed than it shows. The general question about regulation. My own sense is that, again, one has to be rather nuanced about this. It's not really the case. I mean, I'm in favor of having something like a public service broadcaster because I think that if you don't have that, then paradoxically, the breadth of opinion that's represented on air actually reduces. And I think that the comparison between something like Britain and through the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, and the United States as the broadcasting scene has developed here, bears that out. So my own sense is that the BBC, to be specific about it, is a good thing, but it's a good thing as one voice among many. I wouldn't want to make the argument for it being a cultural monopoly, as it tried to be from 1920 through to about the mid-50s, when it lost the monopoly first in television and then in radio. The other thing to say about that, which gets back to the O Brother, Where Art Thou film, is that pirate radio, to use that phrase loosely, unauthorized, often kind of anarchic or very sometimes rather locally based or politically supported smaller stations that take on the big networks, whether those networks are public service ones or not, that's a phenomenon which is as old as radio itself. It actually predates broadcasting. So you can find people being denounced as pirates on the radio sphere before the early 20s, even when broadcasting got underway. It's the character of it, though, has changed depending on what the character of the mainstream enterprise of broadcasting is. So in the UK, pirate radio in the 60s was this happy-go-lucky kind of commercial, pop music-orientated thing. Pirate radio in the United States was not necessarily that way. In the 60s, there was a pirate radio movement in the US as well, and it was much more, if you like, countercultural and politically it was to do with advocacy for things like minorities against the man, things like that. That's a rather different ethos from what it was in the UK.
Our guest in this hour again is Adrian Johns. He's professor of history at University of Chicago, and his special area of interest is intellectual property and piracy, that is, in the theft of intellectual property sense. He has written this book. It's about pirate radio in the UK in the early 60s. The Death of a Pirate is the title, and it's just out. It's from W.W. Norton. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I want to talk at least a little bit about the story here that is at the heart of the book and about this conflict between these two men, Oliver Smedley and Reg Calvert. Smedley, interestingly enough, you have this idea that people who were involved in pirate radio in the UK were people who were interested in entertaining and in putting out a certain kind of thing, and that maybe they had a political agenda, but it certainly wasn't a conservative one. Well, interestingly enough, this guy, Oliver Smedley, had a very conservative agenda. He was interested in attacking the British welfare state and apparently thought that one of the best ways to do that was to attack what he saw as an important agent of state power, that being the BBC.
That's right, yeah. Smedley was a follower, if you like, of people like Friedrich Hayek, eventually ended up in Chicago, of course. So he's a very conservative figure in many respects. He believed that the BBC was the linchpin of the welfare state which had developed in Britain after World War II, especially under the Attlee government, the Labour government that did things like nationalising healthcare and the coal industry in the late 40s. So for Smedley, to challenge the BBC monopoly was to perhaps open the door to a much broader challenge to this entire post-war political consensus. If you like, he's a harbinger of what happened in 1979 with the election of Margaret Thatcher. You see the end of that consensus among both political parties that had really persisted since 1945 around the welfare state and the idea that there were great national champions of industry that should be under public control. So he banded together with a small group, a music entrepreneur called Alan Crawford, who was from Australia, and a theatrical impresario called Kitty Black. And they put together what they called Project Atlanta, which actually predated Caroline in its organization, as I said at the beginning, even though it was, in the end, second on the air. They bought up a disused pirate radio ship that had been employed actually off Scandinavia earlier than this, had it refitted, and was set up to become Radio Atlanta, which was going to be the thin end of the wedge for taking down the BBC network. And for him, it was very much a political enterprise. That's very clear. The other thing about Smedley was that he was a financial, what can I say? He was financially inventive. He was an accountant who had a track record of setting up a great number of rather fishy financial enterprises going back into the 50s. And so he was instrumental in setting up the kinds of international financial operations that could allow a quasi-legal outfit like this to operate. So the boat was leased through middle companies in Liechtenstein. There was another company in, if I remember right, Panama. And it would have been very hard to actually track the money, as it were, through these different companies. Mm. And Smedley, I think, was the person who set all that up.
And isn't it also the case that, though, that his operations, and in fact all of these operations, we're always having financial problems because a lot of the people who went into them didn't apparently have a very good understanding of what it would actually take, financially speaking, to keep them going. So they were always in trouble.
That's very true. They were undercapitalized, to put it mildly, a lot of these. And they didn't realize how expensive it was going to be to run a sophisticated transmitter system, and to do it especially on board a ship in the North Sea. I mean, the sea can get pretty rough out there, and these ships were often rather old, beaten-up vessels, you know, World War II minesweepers and the like. So maintenance was expensive as well as just getting going in the first place. And obviously it was hard to put into port in the UK because they might run afoul of the authorities if they did. So victualling the ships was expensive as well. All of the pirate stations ran into financial problems of one kind or another. The ones that were more successful tended to have big influxes of cash at the beginning, often from the United States. There was a car dealing operation in Texas that underwrote one of them, as I recall. And that would tend to tide them through the first difficult months when they built up an audience and could then sell themselves to advertisers and charge, you know, market rates for advertising time.
Mm-hmm. We're just about at our midpoint here. We have another caller, and would welcome others into the conversation. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We're talking again this morning with Adrian Johns. He's professor of history at University of Chicago. His new book is Death of a Pirate, British Radio and the Making of the Information Age. Here's a caller here where we are, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi, fascinating topic. I never knew about the political dimension of these pirates. I thought they were just pop music entrepreneurs trying to get the stodgy BBC to play something else. So why this guy from Texas advertise there? Did I hear that correctly? I guess he maybe was just a Hayek follower or something that was joining in.
I don't know the details of his motivation, but he was an underwriter of one of the stations. And I think for commercial reasons as much as anything else. The thing was that if you could set a station up like this and get it to work and dominate what would then become a realm of commercial radio in the UK, the potential for profit was very great. You know, once the thing was underway and once you'd established a precedent for your existence, then the market for advertisers was enormous. And you could see this not least in the concerns that Fleet Street had about it. Fleet Street is very ambivalent about the commercial radio stations because it sees a real competing media sector arising. So I think that the Texan group, although it may have had libertarian Hayekian ambitions as well, was primarily in it for the money.
I see. Not that they're mutually exclusive, I suppose.
No, sure. of course not.
Yeah, well, I guess the BBC got unstodgy in having Joe Strummer and John Peel on, both late, though it's a shame. I actually was motivated to call because of, you mentioned the political nature and counterculture nature of pirates in the U.S. I was thinking of the other places where there were the post office type monopolies, and I was thinking specifically of Germany and specifically of Radio Dryatland. Do you know any of their story? Because I can outline it a little bit. They actually came out of the Green Movement, and they came out of opposing a nuclear plant in Fessenheim, I believe. And now there's two of them. One of them is in Alsace and went commercial, but I guess the one in Freiburg is still an alternative station. They went on illegally in 85 and campaigned to be licensed. They were broadcasting in from the Swiss border, if I recall, into the south of Germany.
I hadn't heard of that, but that's a fascinating example. And I think one could multiply examples like that, especially in Europe. Sorry, go ahead.
There's actually a solidarity movement here through an association of community radio stations. In fact, they were urging people to call in other radio stations in Twin for a while, which the station here at WFT that I do a show with actually did. And we broadcast simultaneously for a little while, trying to urge the German government to at least authorize some community access to stations. They've done a whole lot more subsequently, and it's an untold story. Perhaps that's the one. All right. Thank you. Very good.
Well, thank you very much.
To take a step back, you were talking in response to the caller about the fact that the pirates felt that there was potential to make money doing this and selling commercials. And I guess maybe it'd be worth making the point that in Britain at this time, in the UK at this time, there was no commercial radio broadcasting. It just didn't exist.
That's right. It didn't exist. But there was sufficient precedent to show that could you make it exist, then there was a lot of money there to be made. So back in the 30s, before World War II, there were commercial broadcasters, which were based in London, but they would use transmitters on the continent to broadcast English language programming into the UK. And they made fantastic amounts of money. There was a group called the IBC, the International Broadcasting Corporation, which was run by a Tory MP called Leonard Plugg. And Plugg became a multi-millionaire out of this. The transmitters in the end were destroyed in World War II. But he really showed that if you could set up an operation like this and keep it running, then potentially it was an enormous money spinner.
Yeah, and you you mentioned Fleet Street. Maybe people will not understand that terminology. Essentially, we're referring to the British print, British press, newspapers, and so forth. That they were not keen on this idea that they might have competition in advertising from broadcasters.
That's right. They saw a potential competitor arising. Fleet Street refers colloquially to the newspaper press in the UK. In the 50s, before these commercial broadcasters started in operation, the newspaper industry in the UK was really at its peak. The rates with which people read newspapers are really stunning to modernize. So enormous numbers of families in the UK would take three newspapers every Sunday, for example. The majority would take one newspaper a day. And so these newspapers could charge advertising rates which were really quite high. And the other thing was that, unlike broadcasting, newspapers can track how many people are looking at them because they know sales figures. If you just send out a broadcasting signal, you can't track that. And that makes setting rates for advertisers more difficult. So that the newspapers were, by the early 60s, seeing their readerships starting to fall or at least stagnate, and were leery of the fact that this whole competing media market might emerge.
Let's bring Reg Galvert into the story. As I said, maybe at the beginning, near the beginning, there is a story. At the heart of Death of a Pirate, there's a story of a murder involving a conflict between two of these pirate broadcasters. One that we've talked about, this man named Oliver Smedley, who was the one who had this political agenda. He thought that by setting up a pirate station, he could attack the BBC and in the process attack the British welfare state. Well, here was another pirate broadcaster, this fellow Reg Calvert, who, unlike Smedley, had no political agenda. It seemed that he was just interested in promoting, in part at least, promoting performers that he managed, and that for him that this was purely the motivation here was purely commercial.
Yeah, pretty much. Calvert was a pop music entrepreneur. He ran bands in the Midlands mainly. And in fact, at one point, he bought up a big old manor house near Rugby, which is more or less in the center of Britain, which he converted into a pop music academy to train bands to become pop acts. And he set up a pirate station on a disused World War II anti-aircraft fort that sits out in the sea in the Thames Estuary. It's still there now, actually, called Shivering Sands, which initially was called Radio Such because one of Calvert's bands, one of Calvert's acts was Screaming Lord Such, who was a kind of cod horror rock star. After about a month, Such backed out and Calvert renamed it Radio City, and it continued to operate as Radio City. And it would broadcast things like the records of the bands that Calvert managed, and Saturday night events from the towns around the Thames Estuary where Calvert's bands were playing. So it was a much smaller scale, you know, less ambitious operation, if you like, than Radio Atlanta, which was Smedley's crew. But in the end, the two of them kind of tried to enter into an alliance because Project Atlanta, Smedley's group, ran into severe financial difficulties. Essentially, they were substantially taken over by Radio Caroline. And Smedley thought that the only way that he could preserve his ambitions was by entering into an alliance with Calvert and taking over this fort station. And things started to go sour very quickly from there.
Well, there, I hope you don't think I'm giving away too much of the story here, but there's this remarkable chapter in this story where after the things didn't pan out in this deal Smedley thought he could work out with Calvert, Calvert went looking for another partner. Smedley actually ended up hiring some guys to mount an assault on Shivering Sands, which they did, and threw everybody, threw out all the staff of Radio City.
Yeah, Smedley and his kind of colleague, if you like, Kitty Black, who was this theatrical impresario, hired a bunch of dockers from London, and they went out on a launch in the middle of the night in June 1966 and took over the fort. And they actually held the DJs and the engineers and so on hostage out there for about a week. The motivation for this is contested to this day. Smedley argued that he had transmitting equipment on the fort, which Calvert was effectively going to steal in order to do his private deal with a rival commercial operator. Calvert's line is that Smedley is holding these people hostage in order to extort an agreement from Calvert to give the fort station lock, stock and barrel over to Smedley to continue Project Atlanta. But at any rate, there was then a series of increasingly angry confrontations between the two men while these DJs were still being held hostage out on the fort. And that led to the culmination.
Another caller here. Let's talk with somebody in Springfield. Line four. Hello.
Yes. A professor of political science who originally is from Britain, and I was sort of commiserating over the fact that there is a very palpable conservatism on the BBC station that we hear starting at midnight. I wonder if either of you perceive the same thing. Thank you.
Well, we run the World Service here on our station overnight.
Okay.
I don't know if you have some thoughts about the political cast of their broadcasting one way or another.
You know what? Having not lived in the UK for more than a decade now, I'm a bit out of touch with how it is on a day-to-day basis, and I don't get to listen to the World Service as much as I would like to. I think it partly depends on what you mean by conservatism. I think there are different branches of that. It's certainly not conservative in the manner of something like Fox News in the US, you know, that kind of hard-edged conservatism. I think, though, that still with the BBC there is, if you like, a certain reverential quality and a tradition which to my mind, is aligned with public service ethos, but which could be characterized as conservative in perhaps a rather staider, more old-fashioned sense. I have to say my own kind of taste is that I rather like that. But as I said, I think before, I like it as one voice among many. I don't like it as being the only voice that one could be allowed to listen to.
Yeah. All right. Well, our guest in this hour, let me again introduce, is Adrian Johns. He's professor of history at University of Chicago. He is a specialist on intellectual property and piracy and is the author of the recent book Death of a Pirate, British Radio and the Making of the Information Age. It's published by W.W. Norton. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, we've told the story a little bit of how things developed here about the conflict between these two men, about the fact that Oliver Smedley had this angry confrontation with Reg Calvert at Calvert's home outside London, and this was June of 1966, and Mr. Smedley shot Mr. Calvert, and he died. There was a trial. He was acquitted, but as a result, there were big changes for pirate broadcasting. What happened as a result?
Yeah, there were very big changes. This is actually it led immediately to what was, I think, was the biggest change in radio broadcasting in the UK between the invention of broadcasting in the 1920s and now. So prior to this point, the BBC had had the legal monopoly on the airwaves, and that would continue, although it was increasingly infringed. What changed was that the government decided that you can't really have people shooting each other, and so something would have to be done about all these ships, and it passed a law that essentially outlawed advertising on these pirate vessels. So it was going to shut down their source of money, and all of the pirate ships, with the partial exception of Caroline, accepted that they would not be able to carry on, and they all shut down pretty much on the day that this law came into operation. But the government also realized that it was politically impossible simply to shut down the entire commercial broadcasting sector by this point, commercial radio sector, I should say. So they also revolutionized the BBC. So the structure of BBC radio, where you have Radio 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, dates from this point. Radio 1 was created essentially by hiring a number of the pirate DJs. So they came in from the ships and were immediately recruited into the BBC and put to work on what became the national pop music station, which was a strange kind of, to people at the time, was a very strange kind of imitation, a facsimile of the pirate stations, because it did things like taking commercial jingles and producing jingles that were not commercial. So Radio 1 had jingles, but without the commercial point to them. Mm. One of your earlier callers mentioned John Peel. And Peel is a great example of how this worked successfully. He originally was a pirate DJ on Radio London, which was perhaps the most financially stable of the pirate stations before this point. He was brought in and became a DJ on BBC. And, of course, he lasted through and became really the dominant influence, I would think, on pop music culture in the UK through to his death.
So the pirate era was relatively short. We're talking about 3-4 years, but actually as a result of the pirates, not only did we eventually we got licensing of commercial stations, but also it really loosened up the format of the BBC. So you could make the argument, I'm sure you would make the argument, that the pirates, by their presence over this relatively short time, had a really profound effect on broadcasting in Britain.
I think they did. The actual formal licensing of commercial radio came a little later. There's a delay about that. But the atmosphere changed profoundly. The other thing to say is that pirate radio didn't go away, and it was kind of thrown into the shadows for a moment with this law that outlawed the ships in the mid-60s. Radio Caroline staggered on for about 6 months until its ship was actually repossessed by creditors. But then in the 70s, it revived. There was a new Radio Caroline, there were new attempts at ships. And more than that, there were urban pirate stations operating within the UK itself, within the cities, often using new, very portable VHF transmitters. So these are very short-range operations. And there's a whole story to be told about the proliferation of those. There were hundreds of them. And they really revolutionized pop music in a new way in the 70s, especially the 80s. So things like the Ministry of Sound, house music, came out of that movement very, very strongly. Mm. So it's something where that moment in 66, 67, where the shooting led to the new law and the eradication of what had been a potential pirate broadcasting network, that is a moment, but it's not the end of pirate broadcasting per se. It's a moment of transition, if you like. Mm.
Another caller here, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I wish to echo the complaint of the other caller about the far right-wing content of the nighttime BBC that we get. I especially, in the interview with Owen Bennett Jones, I keep hearing, I kept hearing, it seems to be not so bad now that the Bush regime is over, but I kept hearing fawning adulation. They kept having John Bolton on, and if they didn't have John Bolton on, they had people singing his praises and talking about how the whole world is against the United States and supporting the Muslim terrorists, and even the UN supports the Muslim terrorists, and we ought to pull out of the UN. The UN is no good. It was just plain God awful. And also, I can't remember, this was not Owen Bennett Jones, but it was somebody else who was talking about how the Republicans were going to remain in power for the foreseeable future because Bill Clinton had behaved in such an absolutely disgusting, vile manner. He was a sex maniac of the worst order, and so forth. And so I just was appalled. And when I talked to people in the daytime about this who hadn't heard nighttime BBC, they said, well, how can that be? The BBC is liberal. So, you know, I thought maybe I'm hallucinating or having auditory, illusions, but apparently somebody else noticed it. Thank God. Okay?
All right.
Well. I haven't heard this myself, but as I say, I don't listen to it. I think the person that you spoke to who was surprised would mirror my sense of this. I would be surprised if the World Service is really like that. I think one of the things that did happen in the mid-60s, which is hard to, as it were, quantify, but is a real change, is that the ethos of the BBC vis-a-vis government became much more critical. As it became one voice among many, for the first time really with these commercial stations, so what had been a rather fawning attitude to government ministers, for example, became much more interrogatory. So if you live in the UK, and especially if you came up as I did, through the period of the Thatcher administration and John Major and then the Blair years, many of the interview programmes that were done in the political sphere by the BBC within the UK in that period, this is not World Service, this is Radio 4 and BBC 1, BBC 2 on television, were actually very critical to the point of being, sometimes I felt rather counterproductively aggressive, to an extent that you really don't see in the US at all. You never see these kinds of very aggressive interviewing techniques adopted in the US. At least I've never seen them. My sense is that that's a shift, as I say, that came about with the confrontation with the pirates in the 60s and has lasted since then. Maybe it's not in the World Service. I just don't know. I mean, I'll go with the views of people who listen to it, which I haven't as much as I probably should, I guess.
We have just about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus with our guest, Adrian Johns. He's professor of history at University of Chicago. His book is Death of a Pirate. It's about particularly about British pirate radio in the UK in the, say, mid-1960s and how that changed broadcasting in Britain. Norton is the publisher, and it's a good story. You might want to take a look at it. Well, just one of the things I'm curious, you point out in the book, you give something of the history of the development of broadcasting in the UK and of the BBC, and perhaps people would know that in Britain, in the beginning, when there was just radio, you paid a license fee for your radio, and then when television came along, it became a television license. So you're supposed to pay for that, and then that money goes to fund the BBC. And as you point out, though, in Britain early on, maybe when people talked about radio pirates, what they were talking about was people who were listening without paying the license fee. That was a big concern about trying to chase down people who were listening without paying. What these days, what do people think in the UK about the license fee? Is there still support for that idea that if you have a television, you pay a fee and then that money goes to support the BBC?
It still exists, certainly. You are still supposed to pay a license fee. It's a regular bone of political contention in the UK. I don't know whether you've followed this recently with the election of the new coalition government, which is proposing austerity measures across the board.
Yeah.
One of the controversies has been what level to set the license fee at, because the BBC under the Labour administration had been hoping for increases to allow for the maintenance of its essentially global media operation. It now seems that the license fee is not going to be increased. And that's partly a general part of the government's austerity measures, but it's also ideological. I mean, the Conservatives are much less aligned, if you like, with the idea that this is an appropriate way of financing a public service broadcaster. They're much less aligned with the idea that there should be a public service broadcaster per se. My sense of it is that there doesn't seem to be a general public determination to get rid of license fee funding. I think people are pretty fond of the BBC in the way that they're fond, perhaps, of the National Health Service. You know, they see it as providing a reasonable service, and they also look at other countries, principally the United States, that don't really have a counterpart, and think, often it must be said on you know, very partial evidence, we don't want to go there. You know, we want to have something which sets us apart and which is different and distinctive and which upholds certain principles of breadth and diversity, ironically enough. So I think that my sense of it is that there are complaints about the level of the license fee, as with any kind of tax. You know, people want it to be as low as it can reasonably be. But I don't see there being a general public determination to get rid of the license fee altogether.
Mm. Now, down to the last couple of minutes here, I want to come back to the death of a pirate and to have you talk about what it is perhaps that this has to say about where we are now. Here we have a story of some rogue entrepreneurs who are taking advantage of a loophole in the law to do something here in telecommunications that challenged the existing system. So is there some kind of parallel or some kind of connection between that and what was happening there and where we are now?
I think there are parallels that operate on perhaps a couple of levels. Mm-hmm. One is just the phenomenon of the multiplication of broadcasting sources with digitization and global networks. So radio is really, in some ways, ideally suited for the digital future, or at least it should be. You know, it's now the case that you can listen to radio stations from anywhere in the world, more or less, you know, at any place in the world. But there are property constraints, legal constraints, governmental constraints of one kind or another that put that possibility under threat. And this is a big debate, as you're probably aware, in the circles in Washington at the moment. How can the potential for sound broadcasting over the internet be upheld and realized as much as possible? So there's an age, if you like, where new operations which are skeptical of these kinds of centralized principles like performing right, copyright, things like that, might enter into their own again. The other thing is a question of, if you like, ethos. I think one of the interesting things about the contrast between Oliver Smedley, this conservative, libertarian, if you like, Hayekian figure, and Calvert, the much more experimental, anarchic figure, is that they could be taken as representative of two types in the history of media in the 20th through into the early 21st century. And you see both of those types in the communities of digitarati today. One is, you know, rather politically committed libertarian, and the other is very democratic and experimental and sees creativity arising everywhere. And we haven't really worked out how those two things mesh together in a coherent way, I think, as a culture. And I think that's something that we're going to have to face up to at some point, maybe in the next generation. Hmm. It's not quite as direct and concrete a question as that of, say, providing for digital radio through regulatory systems. Yeah. But it's still a question. I think we're going to have to face it.
Well, certainly for people who are in the business that I work in, who are old-fashioned terrestrial broadcasters, are very concerned about what the Internet means. And I suppose there are some people who make both kinds of arguments that either it's going to kill us or it's going to save us. And nobody is exactly sure which.
I think that's right. Nobody's sure which at the moment. You know, I'm an optimist. I tend to think that it has the potential, at least, to produce a new golden age of radio. But then, you know, I like radio.
Me too, and us too. But is there the central issue there? Does it seem to resolve around issues of intellectual property and how they get resolved?
Right now, it does seem to devolve onto those to a great extent, yes. One of the big threats to the idea that you can have a kind of global proliferation of local voices over the digital networks is that the royalty fees that are charged by the big recording companies are sufficient to block the development of these voices. And the question is, at what point is it appropriate maybe to set limits on these royalty fees by whatever means? I mean, maybe government intervention or whatever, because they run the risk of clamping down on what would ideally be an enormous new range of creativity and only allowing the big network corporations to survive.
Well, we are going to have to leave it at that. For people who want to read more on this story, you look for the book Death of a Pirate, British Radio, and the Making of the Information Age. Adrian Johns is the author. He is professor of history at University of Chicago. The book is published by W.W. Norton. And Professor Johns, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.